Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and at this time we begin the second half. I know you guys have heard this hundreds of times before, but I give a little bit of a talk in the beginning to explain to the newcomers what is the TechNet and what we're seeking to do. It's a gathering of people in the New York City area, but also outside of the area by way of IRLP and Echolink, where we educate each other. That's the main motivation, education. Ham radio is a fairly complicated hobby, and we'd like to know a little bit more about how it works, how to make it work better, how to enjoy it. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter ham radio you're listening to right now is just one of the 26 kinds, and there's lots more. And people want to know something about how the hardware works, and that's the majority of our questions. And the menu, so to speak, the way the TechNet is run, is that in the beginning, people will sign in, give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. We then handle those questions in the order in which they occur. That usually takes about an hour, hour and a half on the average day, but there's sometimes days that are shorter and some days that are longer. Let me drop. We try to make a sincere effort that each guy who signs in the beginning of the TechNet will get at least a brief answer to his ham radio related question. Now, what kind of questions are relevant for the ham radio, for the TechNet? And those are of any question of interest to a ham radio operator. Usually it involves the hardware, propagation, the modes of operation, the many kinds of ham radio, but it also involves the philosophy, how to get more enjoyment, regulatory issues and whatever. And ham radio operators, in my opinion, are minor scientists, sometimes major scientists. One of our chief ham radio operators just happens to be a Nobel laureate. I'm talking about the guy who invented WSJT, Joe Taylor, and K1JT, I think is his call letters. Anyhow, the subjects of interest to ham radio operators can sometimes go pretty far and wild after that. Beyond the first hour and a half, the next thing is that John, KC2WGB, who is trying to take over for what Mel used to do. Mel, K2KNB, for lots of years would collect emails and snail mails from amateurs that don't yet have their license and have questions. Therefore, they don't have a way of simply getting onto the TechNet and asking their question. The majority of what the TechNet has done for the last 29 years is to answer people's questions live on the spot with audio. We're not promising to try to serve as a written consulting service. That's a little bit beyond the call of duty. We make an exception when it comes to new amateurs with their questions because they haven't got a way of getting on the TechNet directly. After John gives us a few of the general questions that he gets that he thinks will have wide interest, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing lately. You'd be amazed how many people are very interested in that. And there's quite a few ham radio operators who have listened directly to the telemetry signals in the downlink from a number of the NASA space probes, satellites, and whatever. So that's an interesting subject. Beyond those things that I just mentioned, approximately 1.5 hours, 2 hours into the TechNet, we then go into the more serious stuff. Admittedly, the more serious stuff is not of interest to everybody. That's a given. In other words, there's a series of experiments going on by a group of people in the New York City area following some of the research that's been going on in Europe for the last few years with reference to machines that do unusual things with reference to electronic power. And so how do you make those measurements? How do you confirm or deny what they're doing? Not everybody's interested in that. But it's taking place 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night when the machine would ordinarily be quiet. So if a person who doesn't like to listen to that material, he doesn't have to. Let me drop. There are people who are saying that they wish that didn't take place. Well, yes, it doesn't interest everybody, that particular kind of material, but the machine would be dead quiet at that time. So they'd rather listen to quiet than material that a number of people are interested in. And I do get some complimentary letters on that. So you can't please everybody. That's the main conclusion we've slowly come to. For 29 years, the TechNet has existed. September of 1982 is when it began. There's now thousands of hours of recorded TechNets. The last 6 years, you can play them back by listening, by going to the website, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And there you'll see the last 6 years of recordings. How many nets do you know that have lasted for 29 years under essentially the same leadership? How many of them do you know who have thousands of hours of recording? So somebody must be enjoying it, or it wouldn't take place. Yes, there are people who make suggestions from time to time. And we who are involved with the TechNet claim to be adaptable, and therefore we adjust. So the current schedule has been arrived at after a number of suggestions, a number of ways of trying it. The more controversial situation is that when a person turns on his radio for the first time, 10:30 at night, hears technical questions being discussed and says, hey, I've got a question, I want you to address it immediately. I haven't got time to wait. And we're going down a list that we've decided to, from the very beginning, we handle the questions in the order in which they come in. And can a person get immediate service who says he can't wait? We try to handle those, but it's beyond the call of duty. It's not part of the original schedule, if you know what I mean. We'll do the best we can, but that person most likely is going to be unhappy to some degree. Okay, that gives you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch as to what it is, what we're doing, what we're attempting to do. And a little bit of humor gets in from time to time. Also, when it comes to the more deep subject, if you want to be able to look at the actual web material itself, it's related to that. There is a website on limarc.org, which I believe that material is being replaced, repeated. Also, you can go to Bernie's site, which is bernie@huntfamily.com, bernie@huntfamily.com, and there you'll also hear K2YO's site, in which he is giving everyone a chance to see the material that actually is being discussed at the later time. So right now I'm going to take check-ins. So please give me your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
82 AMZ with a question.
And Mr. AMZ, or what is your name, sir?
Good evening. The name is Mike. 82 AMZ. The name is Mike, and I have a question.
You're on the list, Mike. Alpha Mike Zulu. All right, Mike's number one. Who else would like to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time with the word yes after that.
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Yankee, Ray.
Okay, Ray is number two, Mike Yankee. Anyone else? Give me your call letters, name, and the word yes at this time.
US2N, Paul, with a space report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And you're allowed to ask a question, too, if you've got one. Okay, one last call. Anyone else with questions or comments that they want to sign in the beginning of the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
N2LDY, question.
Okay, November 2, Lima Delta Yankee. Please tell me your name, sir.
My name on this end is Don, Delta Oscar November.
We got you, Don. And I'm going to make one more call for anyone with questions or a comment. I'm going to give a nice long delay just in case somebody is trying to sign in by way of Echo Link or IRLP, and I know it takes a little bit longer to check in, so I'm going to give a nice long delay. If you want to, if you're out of the area and you want to check in right now, give me your call letters and name, K2RIW. Okay, I didn't hear any of that time. So, Mike, you're number one on the runway, Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Mike Zulu. Go right ahead with your question, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Well, good evening, Dick. Thank you for running the TechNet. I find it very useful. My question is regarding grounding. I'm about to set up an HF rig in my apartment in Pennsylvania. I happen to be home on the weekend here. The problem is I'm on a second floor. I'm going to be with limited space. I'm running a GRV5 mini antenna. The nearest ground is about 20, 30 feet away, and it's a driven rod. I've been informed I should use an artificial ground. I don't quite understand how an artificial ground works, and I have a pretty good idea of why my ground wire to the ground rod won't be such a good idea. Thought about connecting my ground to my cold water line, but I think I would have problems with my neighbors in my apartment building. So my general question is grounding. Back to you.
I picked up the wrong mic. That's a darn good question, and it was one of the subjects that's been, for multiple years, one of the lectures given at the Ham Radio University that's held at the Old Bethpage, which was 1 or 2 weeks ago, every January. Now, there's at least three reasons that people do grounding, Mike, and I suspect from the way you worded it, it's the RF ground that you're most concerned with. But the first and major reason why people do grounding is to lower the capability of the equipment giving them an electrical shock, human being electrical shock. So that's the main reason why you've got a third prong on the safety wiring of the plug that goes into the wall, and that kind of grounding, of course, is very important. The second reason why some people do grounding is for lightning protection. And there's a whole bunch of rules and regulations as to how you do lightning grounding. The third reason we do grounding is that we amateurs sometimes need and often believe that the radio equipment will behave a lot better if it's really grounded, radio-wise grounded. And the so-called artificial ground addresses that one. So I'm going to jump right to the third subject, radio grounding. And the only reason why radio grounding of an antenna system would be required is if the antenna itself is an unbalanced kind of an antenna. If you're feeding a dipole, and the G5RV is a kind of a dipole antenna, and if that dipole antenna has the right kind of a balancing device, our main reason for a balancing device is to stop any common mode current crawling back down the outside of the transmission line. And it could even happen if it's twin lead. What really happens at your antenna, let me drop, is that the transmitter is really a kind of a pump, and your transmission line is just transferring the pumping action from the shack all the way up to the antenna. But right at the point where the antenna is connected by the transmission line, on the first half cycle, what your pump is doing is drawing some charge out of the left-hand side of the dipole and shoving it into the right-hand side of the dipole. On the second half of the RF cycle, it does the opposite. Takes the charge out of the right-hand side and sends it to the left-hand side. If, for instance, you were feeding your antenna with coaxial cable to a dipole, and if you did the thing that many of us do in the beginning, where we simply take the shield of the cable, connect it to the left half of the dipole, take the center conductor, connect it to the right half of the dipole, and that works. It's not ideal, but it works. The signal goes down the inside of the transmission line. It's thoroughly shielded until it hits the antenna. Mother Nature likes a dipole to be a balanced structure. When you're feeding a dipole, Mother Nature tries very hard. At the instant at the right-hand side of the dipole is at, say, plus 10 volts, she wants the left-hand side to be at minus 10 volts. She tries to make it a balanced system on the first half cycle, and then it reverses on the second half cycle. So there is going to be voltage on the half of the dipole that's fed by the coaxial shield of your transmission line. Therefore, after the antenna is doing its thing, some of that leftover voltage travels back down the outside of the coax cable, back down into the shack, and you could have RF energy in the shack because of that problem. The right kind of a transformer or balancing device at the antenna would stop that from happening. Everything would be perfectly shielded. And even if you don't want to go out and buy one of these Unideller or other W2AD or any of these other popular devices that are nice mechanical and do a good balancing device, it acts as an RF choke, so to speak, you can make a poor man's equivalent. Let me drop. The poor man's equivalent of a balancing device, which really is an RF choke, is to take 3 or 4 turns of the coax cable. The exact diameter doesn't matter, but make a coil of coax cable 3 or 4 turns right at the antenna, tape it together, and now that RF energy that wants to flow back down the coax cable on the outside sees that RF choke, and the majority of it no longer goes all the way back down into the shack. The signal that goes down the center of the coax cable going through the choke doesn't even know there are multiple turns there. So with the balloning device, with the poor man's ballon, the RF choke of turns of coaxial cable. No other grounding is required for radio reasons. Now, if you happen to be feeding an unbalanced kind of an antenna, an NFED ZEP, for instance, yeah, you'd like to have some local grounding at the end of the cable. And the so-called RF ground, what it really does is to try to remove electronically the length of the cable. In your case, the length of the ground wire. In your case, you're on the second floor, you're 30 or 40 feet above the ground, above Mother Earth, and you could run a grounding wire, a piece of 6-gauge or 8-gauge wire, out the window, down to a grounding rod in the ground, and because of the length of that wire, it has a significant amount of inductance. It's not a perfect RF ground. I'm not saying you need one, but if you think you need one, if you want that to be act like a ground, because it ordinarily would have a certain amount of inductance to it. However, if that piece of cable going down to the grounding rod happened to be an even number of half wavelengths at your operating frequency, the magic of a half wavelength of wire or coax cable or anything else, half wavelength reproduces the impedance. The wire is being well grounded at the grounding rod. Let me drop. And if you have an exact number of half wavelengths of wire between that grounding rod and the thing you want grounded, maybe it's the chassis of the transmitter, then it will act like a ground. And at that particular frequency, with your QSY or go to another band where that piece of grounding wire is no longer an odd number, an exact number of half wavelengths, now you're going to see the inductance of that wire. The so-called artificial ground just acts like an antenna tuner, so to speak. It electronically adds or subtracts length of that wire to force that wire to again be in an exact integral of a number of half wavelengths, and therefore you're reproducing the ground at the bottom way back at the top in the shack, if you know what I mean. I don't think you need it. As long as you understand the only place where RF energy in the shack can be coming from, it's almost always an imbalanced feed of an antenna or an unbalanced antenna. As long as you're willing to do the right kind of choking, I don't think you need grounding for RF reasons. There are also lots of guys who think that if the equipment is properly grounded, all television interference will disappear. There's a lot more to that story, and many times that's not true. Maybe this helps a little bit, Mike, and maybe you've got some further questions on this one. KD2, Alpha Mike Zulu, K2RIW, the TechNet.
TechNet answers some questions. The antenna that I purchased, they call the GRV5 Mini, which each leg is 32 feet in length. Then it goes to a piece of 300 ohm twiddly wire at 17 feet. According to the guy who makes it, it says that 17 foot in essence matches it, and it goes straight to a coax connector into my rig, which is what I plan to use because that will fit into my cord.
In the case of the G5 RV Mini that you just described, the 17 feet of open wire twin lead connected directly to the coax cable, if that intersection, in other words, the antenna itself is a balanced structure, the twin lead is a balanced structure, but then you're making direct connection to the equivalent of a piece of coaxial cable, even if it's just connected right on the back of the rig itself. So it's at that transition where you don't have a balanced structure, if you know what I mean. The way the rig is going to feed that twin lead is that if the center pin goes to the right-hand side of the twin lead, you're making that side hot. The shield of the coax connector is going to the left-hand side of the twin lead, and you're trying to make that side cold. But the antenna wants to be balanced, the twin lead wants to be balanced, and at that transition of twin lead to rig, you're forcing an imbalance. The right kind of a balancing structure there would stop any RF current from flowing in the shack, flowing back that down that transmission line, so-called common mode current. In the case of a G5 RV Mini, I don't think it's a problem. I don't think grounding is required. if you just go and use it, it's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to burn up, if you know what I mean. And if you do get RF in the shack, I mean, in the old days, a guy running a 500-watt transmitter with an unbalanced transmission line would walk up to his D104 mic. It's got a metal case to the microphone. And as he puts his lip near the microphone, an RF, a spike of RF current, an arc occurs between his lip and the mic, and it's uncomfortable. Now you know you really got RF in the shack. And there's ways of correcting that. RF grounding is maybe not the best way. And will it make an improvement? Yes, but you're attacking the symptom, not the cause. The cause is the imbalance at the point of improper connection. So what I'm saying is that there are kinds of antenna...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If this is the best of all worlds, you might be using an ideal antenna tuner. Some of the better antenna tuners really have a 300 ohm set of connectors on the output, possible connector on the output of the antenna tuner. You can also build yourself a structure that properly feeds 300 ohm twin lead. It's called a half-wave coaxial balun. It consists of literally half-wave of coax cable looped back on itself into a U-shape. The shields of the U-shaped baluning device, coax, plus your main transmission line, all three of those shields get connected together. One of the center conductors of the U-shaped device goes over to the center conductor of the main transmission line feeding it, the coax cable. And now the two center conductors of the U-shaped piece of cable feeds the twin lead. That is a so-called coax balun. That forces completely balanced RF energy on the twin lead. At the instant, the right-hand side of the twin lead is at plus 10 volts. At that exact same instant, the left-hand side of the twin lead will be at minus 10 volts. That's a thoroughly balanced way of feeding, as you can tell. Unfortunately, that device that I just described to you, although it forces perfect baluning, it also makes a 4-to-1 impedance match. Let me think about that. Or is it? Yes, it's a 4-to-1. Your 50 ohms will become 200 ohms, which maybe is the right way to do it. You're feeding 300 ohm twin lead. So, as you can see, there's more than one way of solving this problem, but just creating a so-called good RF ground, as I said before, from my point of view, Mike, it's attacking the symptom, not the original cause. But this is not something that's super important. You can just go and use it and make improvements downrange if you think it's not working well. Lots and lots of guys in your situation just simply connected the twin lead directly to the coax connector on the back of the rig, and everything was hunky-dory.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And everything was very well after that. So I wonder if some of this makes a little more sense, Mike. And if you don't quite understand it, you're allowed to come back in future weeks and ask the question again. And after we go down the list, if there's some extra time left over, you're allowed to ask the question again. KD2 AMZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, Mike was very noisy through the machine, but I was hearing him on the input. And what Mike repeated is that his major concern is he doesn't want his neighbors to be unhappy. He's worried about television and telephone and radio interference. And the main thing that creates interference to your neighbors, Mike, is really not a grounding problem. That's a minor causative agent. If your particular antenna radiates, let's say, 100 watts of power, and if that antenna is physically located close to the neighbor's antennas, the neighbor's equipment, the wiring of his house or whatever, by multiple means, you couple RF energy into his environment, there is a certain probability that his over-the-air digital television tuner is going to become unhappy, his telephone might become unhappy, and so on. So that when people do run into television and telephone interference, creating physical separation between your antenna and that neighbor's equipment is usually the first approach. Yes, RF energy crawling down your feed line. RF energy crawling down your feed line. I think there was some other person addressing us. I'm going to get back to you in a second, sir. RF energy crawling down your feed line, and your feed line running past the neighbor's apartment certainly can aggravate the problem. And the feed line, the twin lead in your case, would not be radiating. It would be a perfectly shielded structure, even though your eye doesn't think it is. It would be a perfectly shielded structure if and only if it is fed in a thoroughly balanced manner, like with that half-wave coax balun I just described to you. And if you simply Google the words half-wave coaxial balun, you'll find lots of ham radio articles telling you how it works, showing you how to build it, pictures of it, and so on. Was there a person who just signed in right now? Give me your call letters one more time, sir. K2LIW in the TechNet. I thought I heard a voice during that one. So, good luck with that project, Mike. Please come back and let us know how it works, successful or unsuccessful. And we'll discuss it some more. Ray was the next person who signed in. Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Yankee, I think it is. Go right ahead, Ray. K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. K2 Mike Yankee. It's a question, I guess, because I like to hear you explain things. I don't understand it fully. Maybe you could talk about takeoff angle, what it is, and how do I change it, and why it's important.
Hey, Ray, you sound like a DXer. That's the kind of a guy of the 26 kinds of ham radio, and I'm a VHF guy from way back. The HF people really worry about the takeoff angle. In other words, the way the ionosphere behaves, when you're making a real long-range DX contact, you're trying to talk to your buddy in London or South Africa or Australia, something that's pretty far away, you know that the signal is going to be bouncing off the ionosphere. I use the word bounce in quotes because it's more complicated than just a bounce, but we're going to call it a bounce. You're bouncing off the ionosphere, and your signal will bounce off that ionosphere better and better, and your distance that you can talk to people gets longer and longer if you can force that angle of incident between the ionosphere, which is a sheet of material, it's a plasma sheet of material, 65 kilometers in the air, we'll say, and it's parallel to the Earth. And if you can make your radio signal hit that ionospheric sheet at a very narrow angle, at a very grazing angle, you get a stronger signal on reflection. The signal reflects a longer distance. Everything good happens. In order for that to happen, the signal coming out of your antenna, you want it to leave your antenna and run almost parallel to the ground. That's the so-called elevation angle or takeoff angle. And if your signal is very high on its takeoff angle, where it goes straight up in the air, hits the ionosphere, and bounces right back down to you, that's a great way to go if you're trying to make a very short-range contact. You're trying to talk to somebody half a state away. That's called the NIVAS antenna, near, vertical, incident, sky wave, straight up and straight back down. Let me drop. So now, if you're a real DX hound and you want to get long-range DX, you want to talk to guys far away, you want to hit that ionosphere at the lowest possible angle. And when you do that, you don't have to make three bounces off the ionosphere to get between here and Africa. You're going to do it with two bounces or one bounces. So there's a whole lot of good things that happen. If you can make your signal leave your antenna, run roughly parallel to the Earth, just with a very slight elevation angle, finally go out there at the Earth's curvature, eventually go out and hit the ionosphere at the shallowest angle it possibly can, and you're going to get the most amount of performance. That's what you desire. Okay, now how do you make it happen? There's only about two ways you can make that happen. Number one, the obvious way is the most difficult, and you're not going to do it. The obvious way is to use an antenna that's got extremely high directivity. If you're a guy like that man in Japan who has a 180-foot long boom of a Yagi on 80 meters, he's got an 80-meter five-element Yagi, full size. That antenna pattern, if you can see the pattern that comes off that antenna, it is a slightly fat pencil beam battery. In other words, the RF energy coming off that antenna, if you could see it with your eye, would look like a flashlight beam. And he aims that flashlight directly parallel to the ground, out there to the horizon, and it probably hits the horizon 700 miles away for the first time and makes a bounce and goes at least 1,500 miles on the very first bounce. That's the direct approach. You and I don't have the resources to do that. The next thing you're going to do is realize that you've got a dipole-like antenna, or maybe something a little bit more complicated than that, and you're trying to make the dipole give you a signal that goes out parallel to the ground. Now you're going to have to suddenly realize what the antenna sees, not what your eye sees. Let me drop. Let's assume now I'm standing out there. I'm on my helicopter. I'm 50 miles away from your house. I'm 500 feet up in the air, and I've got perfect X-ray vision. I'm looking back at your antenna. And your antenna, if it's doing exactly the right thing, it's issuing a signal parallel to the ground, very low elevation angle. I've got my helicopter out there 50 miles away, and I'm looking at that signal. Well, what would I really see? If I had the right kind of eyes, at RF frequencies, what you and I look at, and we call it soil and earth and dirt and lawn and everything like that, and macadam, asphalt, all the stuff that we see that we call ground, we think it's ground. To that radio energy, it is very close to being a mirror. So I stand out there in my helicopter 50 miles away with my binoculars. I look back at your antenna, and what I see is your antenna 30 feet in the air, your dipole. I'm looking at it broadside, and I see a mirror image of your dipole 30 feet below the ground. The real antenna is above the ground. The mirror image is below the ground. I'm looking at two antennas. Unfortunately, that signal that bounces off the ground has a 180-degree phase angle reflection on that bounce if it's a horizontally polarized signal. If it's a vertically polarized signal, it doesn't do that. But many of us are using a horizontal dipole, and that signal bouncing off the ground goes through a 180-degree phase reversal. So I'm now seeing the real antenna above the ground. I'm seeing the mirror image of the antenna below the ground, and it's out of phase. The two signals come to me because they're out of phase. They tend to partially cancel. They cancel if I'm directly away from you, parallel to the horizon. As I start raising my helicopter higher and higher in the air, pretty soon what's happening is that the path length between me and your mirror image antenna is getting longer, whereas the signal, direct signal from my helicopter to your real antenna...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The real signal I see directly to your helicopter, to your antenna, is not getting longer. I'm flying the helicopter in such a way that I keep the distance between me and your antenna constant as I go up in the air. I'm going through a slight arc of a circle, if you know what I mean. So I'm going up in the air, I'm looking directly at your antenna, I'm keeping the distance between me and your antenna identical as I go up higher with the helicopter, but the mirror image signal is going through a longer path. The mirror image signal that I'm looking at from your antenna is below the ground, and that path is growing longer than the direct signal. At some particular altitude, the two signals come back in phase. That happens to be the place where you peak up. In other words, your elevation angle, where you're putting the majority of the energy at some angle in the air, is a function of those two path lengths. You have control over that. Your takeoff angle is directly calculatable depending on how many wavelengths your antenna is off the ground. You think that's ground. That's a mirror surface. So you have control of that elevation angle by way of the fact that there's really an interferometer there. Real antenna above the ground, the mirror image of one below the ground, and the separation between those two, you can control it. It's called the altitude of your antenna. You may have to buy a taller tower. You may have to find a taller tree in order to do that, but there's a calculation. You go to the ARRL antenna book. They'll tell you exactly what the takeoff angle is going to be on your particular band. Once you tell that that program, so to speak, how many feet above the ground or how many wavelengths above the ground is your dipole in my example. Wonder if that makes some sense, Roy. Here we go, Ray. KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, makes good sense, but just one simple question. Is it if the length from the ground to my antenna is greater, is then the takeoff angle shorter or longer?
As you've heard so many antenna enthusiasts say so many times, what makes an antenna work well? Location, location, location. The higher the antenna altitude, the lower the takeoff angle. Because in that helicopter experiment, if you doubled the altitude of your antenna, Ray, what would happen is now as I raise my helicopter, I would see the path to the image antenna move faster, longer than the direct signal path, That's because as you raise your antenna higher above the ground, the mirror image gets lower above the ground. The separation between the two antennas increases. So the higher the altitude, the lower the takeoff angle. So the major factor function that you've got to control the takeoff angle is simply altitude, and with rare exception, the higher the altitude, the better. Now, there are times when a real high altitude antenna, real low takeoff angle, gives you so-called skip zone, where there's a certain number of miles away, maybe 300 miles away, where you're not getting good coverage because the first bounce off the ionosphere hits back down in the ground 1,000 miles away. And so you might want to have a second antenna at a lower altitude, and you flip back and forth between the antennas, depending on who you're talking to. Most of the antennas that we build, buy, install, and whatever, are not the most expensive part of the whole setup. So putting a second, third, and fourth antenna up there, as long as you've got enough trees to hold them, if you know what I mean, there's definite advantage in doing that. Set one of them up north-south, one of them up east-west, one of them high, one of them medium altitude, and flip between them, depending on who you're talking to and what the state of the ionosphere is today. You should be filling up your backyard with wire, if you know what I mean, Ray. KC2, Mike Yankee, K2LAW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick, I got a good understanding of that, and I just want to clarify one more simple question, maybe a stupid question, but so then I'm to assume, I guess, that changing the actual angle of my dipole would give me nothing to do with the takeoff angle. In other words, if I made a V, a downward V, it wouldn't affect takeoff angle at all, whether it's horizontal or vertical. Well, vertical, I think, is a totally different story, but I just want to confirm that. And thank you so much, and that'll be my last question.
Yeah, for one thing, Ray, stop worrying about a so-called stupid question. For the people who come to the TechNet, there is no such thing as a stupid question. It just means that there's a greater gap between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. There are no stupid questions. You're absolutely right. The altitude, the phase center of radiation of the antenna is the main thing that determines the takeoff angle in your backyard with your medium conductivity ground. If you happen to live in the Mojave Desert, where the ground around you is extremely dry sand that has very low reflectivity, life would be a little bit different, but very few of us live in that place. And as you start tilting the antenna, making it a slanting dipole, making it an inverted V, there is a slight advantage of an inverted V. The inverted V, because most of us have one particular tree or one particular tower in the backyard that's the tallest object, and if we put the center of the dipole at that tallest object, the inverted V, you do have a slightly higher phase center of radiation when you do that, even though the tips of the dipole are sloping downward. There's a second advantage of an inverted V antenna. Let me drop. And that is, it's more omnidirectional. A pure horizontal dipole parallel to the ground, similar to the picture we all see in the books that we study in the beginning, we think that's the most ideal dipole. And if I set that piece of wire up north-south, it's going to radiate the best broadside, which means east-west, so it's got the strongest signal to the east and to the west broadside from the dipole. And it's got almost a null in the pattern due north and due south. If I now made it a sloping dipole where the wire is going north-south, now when I look from the south or look from the north, I'm looking at the sides of that dipole wire as a partially vertical antenna. So an inverted V is a beautiful horizontally polarized antenna when you talk about broadside, east and west in my example. When I look at it directly from the north or from the south, it is a vertically polarized antenna, and is radiating quite a bit of signal out there. So there's a second advantage of an inverted V. One, it's easier to mount it high. Number two, it has much less and almost no null off the ends of the antenna. And so it's a more omnidirectional antenna, and it's a win-win, if you know what I mean. Therefore, I recommend you go for it. And on top of that, the wire of the antenna itself. The wire in the antenna itself, just because you see it in the books as being straight piece of wire, whether it be an ordinary horizontal dipole or an inverted V, there's nothing magic about keeping the wire straight. RF energy is blind, if you know what I mean. If because of the particular physical layout of your backyard, you have to zigzag that wire a little bit up and down, left and right, or you have to squeeze it into a piece of property that's not big enough, and you have to put a loading coil or top hat capacitor on the end of the antenna. Don't lose any sleep over that. It's not going to stop it from working. It's just going to make the antenna a little bit more narrow band in its standing wave ratio bandwidth. You won't be able to tune quite as far when you start using those techniques before the antenna starts increasing in standing wave ratio. It does that very slowly. There's nothing magic about the antenna wire being perfectly straight. People also worry about an inverted V where you have a different tilt angle on the left-hand side versus the right-hand side of the inverted V, and they think the antenna is going to explode. It's going to work like a charm. You can build the inverted V as a sloping dipole. You can build it as an unequal slope. On top of that, everyone believes that a dipole must be fed dead center or it's going to explode. There's nothing magic about feeding it in the center. If you've got a balancing device of high enough quality, you can feed the antenna anywhere along the wire you like, including the outer end. And I'm not kidding. As long as you're willing to do a little bit of impedance matching, you can feed the antenna at the outer end instead of the center, and you can get very high performance out of it. That's one of the secrets that's not told to many people, Ray, and now you know it. KC2MMY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K6TP3 with a comment.
Okay, Hal recognized, but back to Ray first. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, thank you. That was extremely informative, and I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I try to listen in whenever I can, and I'm sure a lot of people enjoyed that. And let the other gentleman with a comment go, and I'm pretty much done, so thanks, Dick.
Very fine, Ray. And as you set up that antenna, whether it be an inverted V or whatever, come back and let us know how it's working. It's time to get a little bit of feedback. Hal, last week I did an experiment in your honor. Because of a discussion you and I had, I went to a laboratory and made an experiment. But you probably have already heard about that. You probably heard about the results. And so go ahead and tell us your feeling on probably the inverted V. K6DPZ, K2RIW on TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
K2RIW on TechNet, K6DPZ. No, I didn't, Dick, but the reason why I wanted to come in on is you mentioned inverted V. An inverted V that at one end is very high impedance, and it works very well. We use one in our own station, a matter of fact. It's a half-wave, 80-meter, you know, inverted V dipole, basically inverted V type. We feed it at one end, and it works beautifully on 160 using a ground counterpoise, and it works as a full-wave 40-meter antenna. And at 80 meters, we're driving it with high impedance, and it does a fantastic job. It's not fed in the center, it's fed at one end. So as far as inverted Vs go, you just got to match the impedance and drive it at the end.
That's awful good to know, Hal. Ah, so you did something very unconventional. I bet you the total number of guys feeding an inverted V from one end, I'll be amazed if it's one ham per thousand. Have you ever met another guy doing that? How in the world did you have the nerve to do that, Hal? Didn't you know it's going to explode? I'm kidding you a little bit. How in the world did you know to do it, and have you ever, in all of your ham radio experience, talked to another human being who is doing that? You might be the only guy on the East Coast. K6TPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6TPZ. No, it was mainly a situation where I was using the inverted V as one band, feeding it in the center, and then I thought to myself, feeding it in the center is very frequency selective, and you're limited to what you can do with it. And the way my property is, where my tower is, was more desirable to just jump the inverted V at the top and feed it up front at the beginning, and it worked beautifully. You got to have a good ground counterpoise when you run it on 160, but on 80 meters and on 40 meters, it does a phenomenal job.
K2YO.
Bernie recognized, Hal, it's time you write that antenna up. You're keeping that light under the bushel basket. You're keeping that secret. You have a high-performance, very exotic antenna, and except for you coming on the TechNet and letting the secret out of, letting the cat out of the bag, the rest of us don't even know that that one exists. I've been telling lots of people for quite a few years now, a pure vertical dipole with no insulator in the center, fed at the bottom, right at the ground level, is an extremely high-performance antenna. You can make it purely vertical, you can make it a sloper, and now we're finding out making it as an inverted V is a good way to go. I wonder if Bernie has also done that. Tell us what you've done, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
Well, I cheated and bought one, but I'm curious, could Hal say a couple of words about what is that, what does the circuitry at the feed point look like?
And this is something that I have said a few times. When you feed a dipole in the center, it's approximately a 70 ohm impedance. As you decide to move that center insulator off of center, move it closer to one end, or go all the way and feed the antenna at one end, you're now going to be feeding something close to a 1500 ohm impedance when the antenna is a half wavelength long. And if you want to know exactly what impedance you're going to see, you go to chapter number 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. And you can also find the Brown and Woodward curves by going to amateurradio.tangovictor and look for the article by K2RYW on impedance matching the Yagi, impedance matching dipoles. You'll find it there also. These guys, Brown and Wood, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, spent almost a man year way back in 1968 choosing every diameter of wire, every length of wire, feeding it against the ground plane, and measuring what impedance you get, resistive component, reactive component. You don't have to go and do all that measuring. They've done it for you. All the data is there. So the bottom line is that when you feed one end of a half-wave dipole, it's approximately 1,500 ohms. So you do need an impedance step-up device. The impedance step-up device is not very different than what you've got in the base of a 5/8 wave mag mount. The 5/8 wave mag mount is also feeding a very high impedance. It's basically a coil with a tap point where you feed the coax cable to it. So how did you make that impedance matching device? And of course you've got to retune it when you go from 160 to 80 meters to 40 meters. So give us some words on this one. And I think it's time you write up an article on that one, Hal. K6 Delta Papa Zulu, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
K2RIW, K6TPC. Okay, well, I hope everybody understands my English because I have a Western swag. First of all, if you want to determine the impedance, it's very easy. You can take an antenna analyzer into a tuner, which is a random wire type of tuner, and set the antenna analyzer for the same frequency that you resonated the antenna at. Take a carbon pot, disconnect the tuner from the antenna. Take a carbon pot of about 5K, put your antenna analyzer on the tuner and don't touch it. Take your 5K pot and turn the 5K pot until you see a one-to-one match on your analyzer. Take the pot off, measure the DC resistance of the pot, and it is a feed point impedance of the tuner to the antenna. That's number one. Do you concur with me on that, Richard? Over.
If the antenna is really an electronic equivalent of quarter wave, half wave, three-quarter wave, if it's at one of the resonant points where there is no reactance left over and it's a purely resistive antenna, you and I are on the same page. We're in 100% agreement. If, however, the antenna is a little bit longer or shorter than the right length to be quarter wave, half wave, three-quarter wave resonant, one of the resonant points, then there will be some reactive component left over. The simple potentiometer might not get you to one-to-one, but we'll discuss that a little bit later. Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
Okay, well, if you want to be real sneaky, then you take an RF thermocouple meter, and you measure the RF current feeding the antenna off the tuner, and you measure the RMS voltage at that same point. And if you know the current and you know the voltage, you can figure out the impedance. Do you agree with me on that, Richard?
I sure do, Hal, and that's the overall magnitude of the impedance. But if your antenna happened to be, let me pick a number, one-third of a wavelength long, where it will have, let me think now, third of a wavelength long, it will be a capacitive reactance in series with a resistance. That's the real impedance. Your potentiometer will get you close. It'll get you a dip in the curve. It might come down to a 1.5 to 1 best sustaining wave ratio. But until you also cancel the reactive component, you won't get 1 to 1. So if it's a crazy length of wire, the resistance gets you close, but it doesn't get you all the way to home plate. Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
Then you use a variable capacitor in series with the pot, or an inductor in series with the pot, which is a variable inductor, and then you can null it right out. Do you agree with that, Richard?
Of course. you and I know that the antenna being fed directly in the way you're describing really has an equivalent electronic circuit, which is a series resistor and a series reactor, capacitor or inductor, depending on whether it's a shorter than a quarter wavelength long or longer than a quarter wavelength on the first resonant point. Determines a shorter will be capacitive, the longer than quarter wave will be a little bit inductive. And so measuring that amount of equivalent capacitance and equivalent resistance gives you a one-to-one substitute for the impedance of the antenna. You and I are in agreement on that one. Go ahead, Hal.
We were agreeing totally almost tonight. Okay, well, that's the main thing I wanted to mention. It does work. It's very functional. And as a matter of fact, I run a Johnson AM desk kilowatt, and there's a lot of voltage at the end of that matching system. I use an L matching system to raise the impedance with the inductor and then a capacitor to cross the ground. It's going to be the high impedance of antenna system. A lot of voltage, but it matches with no problem. K2IW, K6DPZ.
So once again, those who have tuned in late, what we're discussing now is feeding a inverted V, a sloper, a half-wave dipole, feeding any of these dipole-like antennas at the outer end instead of the center. Very few people are doing it. As long as you're a little bit smarter and know how to do it, it gives you a tremendous amount of improvement in performance. You don't need as much feed line. And in many cases, physically, it's a lot easier to do. Hal is doing it. And I get the impression, Hal, that the majority of your impedance matching, in other words, when you feed the outer end of a dipole, you're feeding something like a 1,500 ohm impedance instead of a 70 ohm impedance. So therefore, your antenna tuner is matching that 1,500 ohms. So some guys will do it with a real structure out there with some kind of a switching network, depending on whether they're on 160, 80, or 40 meters. I think in your case, you're doing all of it with the antenna tuner, and you just know what the set points are, and you reset the antenna tuner, is my guess. Is that approximately what you're doing, Hal? And you've got a good antenna tuner that's got some nice range to it there. It can match all three of those situations. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ is a good rotary coil, good size rotary coil, with a good size variable capacitor with good spacing. That's the basic tuner I'm using for that application. For lower power applications, I do use just a random wire tuner like an AH4, which is a very broad impedance range. And I can drive that into it because there are two inverted Vs set up in two different locations.
Sounds like your antenna tuner might be a homebrew. That rotary coil tuner, out of curiosity, did that come from a World War II Arc 5 transmitter? Over to you, Hal.
Now, it's got to be a little bigger than that. An Arc 5 transmitter would work. That will feed a random wire instead of inverted V for a couple hundred watts. But when I'm running, I got a very good-sized rotary coil tuner. Got to handle some very high voltages on voice peaks.
Yeah, when you're feeding 1,500 ohms instead of 70 ohms, we can calculate what that voltage is, and it's a lot higher. And if there's any capacitive reactants left over, then it gets even higher yet, because the total impedance goes up when you've got both a series resistor and a series capacitor in the equivalent circuit of the antenna. Okay, after we go through the third person who signed in, after we go through John's Mel's Corner and Paul's space report, if some time left over, Hal, I'll tell you the experiment that I ran last week in your honor and got some very interesting results in the laboratory. Alrighty, the next person who signed in was Don, N2 Lima Delta Yankee. You're allowed to ask questions on anything you like, Don. You got it. N2 LDY, K2 RIW.
Oh, this actually has a pertinence to the original question, the first question of the night. Because I have heard the guys on there talking about grounding and stuff the night before or two nights ago. And my question was, somebody mentioned skin effect. And then I said, well, I wonder if it matters if you're using solid, wire to run the ground or if you had stranded wire, would it make a difference because of the skin effect? That was my question.
There's sort of a yes and a no to that one, Don. If I had a piece of, let me pick a number, 6-gauge or 8-gauge wire, and I measure the resistance in ohms per 1,000 feet, and you can look it up in the wire table, that ohms per 1,000 feet is measured at direct current, zero frequency, or maybe at 60 hertz, where all the current flows through all of the thickness of the wire, and you'll measure a certain number of ohms per 1,000 feet. You take that exact same piece of wire, and with good laboratory equipment, you start making measurements of what is its apparent resistance. In other words, as you go to higher and higher frequencies where you're doing the test, the length of the wire is itself an inductor, and there's ways that you can remove the inductive component and measure how much resistance does the wire really have. So you go higher in frequency, and you're only measuring the resistive component, and you'll see the resistance start climbing, and you'll wonder what's going on. What's really going on is that if you had X-ray vision and you could look inside that wire across the cross-section, as you go higher and higher in frequency, you'll see that the current that used to flow through the whole cross-section of the wire starts crowding toward the outer perimeter of the wire when you're looking at it in cross-section. As you go up to microwave frequencies, the outer 10,000th or 100,000th of an inch of the wire is where all of the RF current flows. And you could take a piece of wire or a piece of a rod, you know, aluminum rod, copper, let's start off with a piece of copper rod. I got a piece of copper rod, I'm making the measurement at, let me say, 1,000 megacycles, and I measure what is the real resistive component of that rod, and then I substitute, instead of the rod, I substitute a very thin wall piece of tubing that has the exact same outer diameter, the exact same copper composition, but 99% of all the copper in the center has been removed. It's now a thin wall piece of tubing, and I put that back into the test equipment at 1,000 megs, and I will measure almost the exact same resistance. Because
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
As you go higher in frequency, the RF energy crowds closer and closer to the skin. So that's what radio energy really does with wire. That's the reason why stranded wire at RF frequencies works better. The limited example of that is so-called Litz wire. Litz wire is a wire that they use for winding coils where they want very high performance out of the coils. And even though it's a very compact coil, you look at Litz wire with a microscope and you realize that it's a whole bunch of 36-gauge wire, I'm guessing, with copper insulation around each individual strand, and a whole bunch of these strands are put together. Each individual strand has skin effect, and the overall outer diameter of a piece of tubing doesn't exist, if you know what I mean. So you can, in the same diameter of conducting structure, get higher conductivity by using Litz wire instead of a piece of a real wire of that outer diameter. So when it comes to the wires now that you string in the backyard for your ground plane radials, for the main radiator, for your dipole itself, you could start worrying about the skin effect. You're probably worrying unnecessarily. If you're building the antenna out of a 30-gauge wire to make it invisible for the landlord, yeah, the resistance of the wire is going to start to giving you a little bit of an effect. But most of the skin effect that we worry about on HF frequencies, it is a minor difference because the resistance of our wires usually are pretty small compared to radiation resistance. I'll make one break and give you some info on that one. With any reasonable diameter wire at any reasonable frequency from 160 meters to 10 meters, for instance, I set up a wider dipole, and maybe I've used 14-gauge household wire. And because of the skin effect, I'm only using the outer few percent of that wire. And therefore, if I made a careful laboratory measurement, because of the skin effect, my piece of wire, my dipole, maybe it has 2 or 3 ohms of resistance because of the skin effect. I'm not using all the copper. But the radiation resistance, the way the radio signal goes down the wire and goes out into space, my transmission line thinks that that is a 70-ohm antenna. So if I've got a 70-ohm radiation resistance, which is made up of 3 ohms of real resistance of the wire, you can see percentage-wise, yeah, you're losing a couple of percent of possible performance. If you made a complete substitute of very large diameter tubing instead of the wire for the dipole. Instead of getting 97% performance, you'd get 100% performance, so to speak. And if you try to measure that difference on your S meter, you better use a very large magnifying glass, if you know what I mean. It's going to be an extremely minor perturbation. So you may be losing sleep, unless you're doing something fairly exotic.